Okay, it's me up first. I've been cooking what I'm going to say to you for the last 24 hours, well, probably the last 67 years, perhaps, but peculiarly difficult to heave something into my mouth. I think it's the nature of the subject. It's not just that it defies conceptual expression. It resists conceptual expression. It's almost as if everything that I think to say starts to laugh at me. But anyway, this down on the programme, so I'd better have a go. There's another thing about it that's a little strange. We're talking about aesthetics. We're talking about, essentially, taste, what we respond to, what we respond to naturally. Well, at the moment, you're all looking at me. And you're going to have responses to all sorts of things about me and what I'm saying. And I can tell from your faces. Sometimes they're this way, sometimes they're that. But there we are, never mind. I've got my responses too, because I'm looking at you. So yesterday I suggested that we focused on the aesthetic moment, that moment when we are transported into a sense of delight and beauty, of engagement with the object. And I suggested we approached it in terms of a threefold analysis, a classic Buddhist analysis, in terms of what I'm calling the known, the knowing, and the knower. You can see it, for instance, in the Salayatana, the sixfold sense fields, where you have the organ, sight, for instance, eye, you have the visual object, and you have the visual consciousness. So that passes all the way through the other five sense fields. And indeed, in later Buddhist theory of mind, it passes into other kinds of consciousness too, in Yogacara. So it seems a very useful framework for examining our experience in terms of the point of view from which things are looked at, the vista that is perceived from that point of view, and the viewing itself. You know, there's the hill up there, Oyster Hill, which is a local viewpoint. Well, when you're up there, you're looking from a certain point of view. And you're seeing a certain scene. But unless you're up there, there's no moment, no aesthetic moment. The vista awaits being perceived from the point of view. Without a knowing, in a sense, there's no vista and no point of view. So we're going to be examining these three elements one by one. And today I'm going to focus principally on the known, the object of perceiving. The object of knowing, not merely perceiving. I'm expanding beyond merely perceiving. And I'm going to approach it from three points of view. I'm going to look at it, first of all, in terms of our actual experience of it, what it feels like, what the object feels like to us in the aesthetic moment. Then I'm going to look at it from a psychological point of view, and finally from a more philosophical or even metaphysical point of view. Of course, the first thing one has to say is that the object is particular. Padmavajra went into that very evocatively yesterday. But why is it that some things appeal and others don't? Why is it that a certain situation, a certain scene, a certain object within the overall object appeals to one and something else doesn't? I think you'd have to say in the end, this is quite difficult to say, it's mysterious, and I don't think it's my job at the moment to go into that. In the end, I think, in principle, anything, any situation, any object can be object of an aesthetic moment. Given the right circumstances, the right state of mind, and so on. Any object can be aesthetically pleasing, albeit that aesthetic pleasure sometimes being quite subtle and sophisticated. I think modern art has been exploring this to a very great degree, and to sometimes I think a little overly conceptual in its approach. But nonetheless, there is a great awareness that the aesthetic moves out of the frame, and that when one's looking at things, it's principally a question of the eye that looks, not the object that is seen. Although some objects seem to provoke that aesthetic moment more than others, and that's not a subject that I am going to go into, I think, during these talks. But you know that probably from your own immediate experience or your own experience. I went recently to the Miro exhibition at the Tate Modern, which made a very big impression on me. And I was in the room with those huge white canvases with just a single meandering line crossing the canvas, and a few shapes in primary red, blue and yellow. And to begin with, I wasn't quite in the mood for them. I went in and, well, I heard a little child come in and said, "Mummy, what are those? I could do that." And I was a little bit in that, you know, what modern art sort of mood. But I got myself sitting down in front of them, and I began to respond to them, and respond to the very mysterious sense of what Kant called, in relation to nature, purposiveness without purpose. Something was being expressed, a meaning was being expressed, but it wasn't a meaning that you could parse into language. And I was absolutely entranced, seeing my mind fighting to grasp what I was seeing. And Miro had done something that completely defied that grasping. But what struck me more was that when I walked out of the gallery, I was seeing everything in the same way. I was seeing everything in that same aesthetic mode. So the aesthetic mode isn't pegged to the object. And yet some objects more successfully communicate that aesthetic moment, or induce, provoke that aesthetic moment, than others. Sometimes it's simply natural objects, and especially nature itself. You know, get up on a morning like this with everything rimed with frost, silvered with frost, the steam rising from the surface of the pond. Well, you know, it can't fail. You can't fail but be uplifted and entranced. And many natural situations are of that kind, although some situations you just don't like, you don't respond to them, and that's a subject for more kind of studied aestheticians than myself to explore. What is the difference between what appeals and what doesn't? And of course, why does it appeal to one person and not another? I'm not so bothered about that at the moment. But in the aesthetic moment, the object appeals. And that's the feeling you get. And this is what I want to explore now, the experiential aspect of the aesthetic moment. It's not that you think about it. It's not that you have to work it out. It just appeals. Appeals as in calls out to you, calls you to it. It invites you into itself. Of course, you don't always have that facility, and that's where critics can be so valuable, and aesthetic educators can be so valuable. People who do see that can often help you to see it. I mentioned yesterday this journey that I took from northern Hungary to Budapest with our Dhamma Mitra, Janos, and him explaining the gypsy music that we were listening to, which he was obviously completely entranced by. And in his explanation of the way in which the voices were working together, the way the harmonies were working, the way in which different parts of the band were working sort of against each other at some points, just like jugalbandi in Indian music, extremely subtle and sophisticated. And through his explanation, the music sort of came out at me and expanded in front of me and pulled me into it. Whereas before, I'd just been enjoying the boppity-bop of it, as it were. But he showed me there's something far more than mere dance music, good dance music, but something far more than that, expressive of very subtle emotions and aesthetic appreciation. I remember again going to the Musée Cluny in Paris, the Museum of Medieval Art, with Bante. And we went into a room which was full of small carved ivory plaques. And, you know, there were hundreds of them. And, you know, frankly, I was sort of wondering, when do we get on to the large things that you can sort of easily understand? But Bante, in his very meticulous way, was examining each one. And I was trying not to show that I wasn't really with it. But at one point, he just looked at one plaque and said, look at the shape of that figure and its interaction with that figure. And again, it leapt out at me and pulled me into it. So an aesthetic educator can be extremely valuable. And I think that's one of the functions that we in our community need to be performing, helping people to know how to see beauty. But that's the effect that beauty has. It appeals the beautiful object, the object of beauty. It appeals to you, it calls you. You don't have to sort of force yourself into it. You don't have to push yourself into it. You have to will yourself into it. Technique fails you. If you use a technique to approach the aesthetic object, you kill it. If you think about it, you kill it. You know, so much criticism that you read in the papers and so forth, the criticism of a film, for instance, that you've seen, and they're so intelligent and so clever about it, and they see things that you hadn't seen. You think, they didn't actually see the film. They're so busy preparing their copy for the next day that they never really let the film appeal to them. And a lot of criticism, I think, is of that kind. It's mere cleverness, as frankly as a lot of so-called art. It's mere cleverness. It's too much thought, not enough direct aesthetic experience. But yes, the aesthetic object itself appeals. It draws you in. It calls you. It grabs you sometimes even. Sometimes it's much more subtle, more seductive, just enticing you very subtly, very gently. Sometimes it comes out and pulls you. And it pulls you with a strong sense of delight. Even sometimes an unpleasant object. You know, for instance, you can't exactly call the last scene of Hamlet a bundle of laughs. You know, the stage is littered with bodies. But there's something so deeply satisfying about the whole play that it passes beyond the superficial unpleasantness of it. Well, Jnanavacha gave me a film to watch quite recently, Culverry, by an Irish filmmaker. It's an extremely good film, and it ends with a very unpleasant shooting, but although it's shocking and horrifying, you never feel that it's just something unpleasant that you're being forced into, like so much horror stuff is. It makes complete aesthetic sense. And even the very shooting of that unpleasant scene calls you into a deeper meaning. So yes, it's pleasurable. That's one of the wonderful things about the aesthetic approach to Dhamma, that it's pleasurable, it's delightful. It's not about your head, it's not about technique, It's about a direct, immediate appeal, which you can be educated in, but you're educated in having that immediate response, which is intensely satisfying and pleasurable, even when it's disturbing or even the object is unpleasant. It appeals, it delights, it pleases. You feel satisfied. You go away from Hamlet feeling deeply satisfied that you've looked into the heart of life, and that you're a better person for having looked there. But that is the aesthetic object. It calls you, it pulls you, and it pleases in one way or another, delights, satisfies. Maybe sometimes the satisfaction is greater than the delight, if you see what I mean. Sometimes it's more of delight with satisfaction. But the aesthetic object, the deeper, or rather the fuller the object is an aesthetic object, the more it communicates meaning. The more when you engage with it, you sense that you are touching on deep meanings in life. This is exactly what I believe Wordsworth meant in that poem, lines written above Tintern Abbey, that something far more deeply interfused. He never says what it is. He doesn't say, oh, what is deeply interfused is, you know, selflessness or something like that. It's not something that can be spelled out. It's if you can spell it out, it's not it. It's something deeply felt, but resonant with meaning. You feel you're touching on the pulse of things, of existence, of life. You feel you're in touch with the heart of things. And in the aesthetic moment, you're satisfied with that. You don't come away from the painting or the film or the play or the poem giving it a meaning. You didn't say, oh, this meant that, this meant that, this meant that. Because that would be to lose the meaning in too shallowly stepping into concepts. Concepts can help to look, but in the end, the felt meaning, to put it that way, is what is important. And what Bante suggested in that, in his account of art as a distinctive emphasis of Triratna, Bante spoke of the capacity of art to communicate dharmic insight, even. And this is the way it does it. It communicates meaning. How it does that, in a way, I'd rather not know. If you see what I mean. If you know how it does it, in a sense you've lost it. It's become a technique. It has to be, at every level, somewhat beyond your capacity to entrap it in words. That was my experience with Miro in that exhibition, that he was sort of saying to my conceptual mind, my intellect, which is, you know, probably the bit that I approach life with foremost, it was just saying, go away, go away. You won't get here with that. And the best of art, the greatest of art, the deepest of art, and of the aesthetic, defies conceptualization. That's why I'm having a little bit of difficulty getting myself onto the platform, because I'm aware I'm going to be using a lot of words to talk about what I should really be singing or dancing or reciting, or perhaps just shutting up. So the aesthetic object has these three characteristics. No doubt there are more, but probably in those three characteristics I think we get at the core of it. It appeals, it pulls us. We don't have to push ourselves into it. If we push ourselves into it, it dies. It delights, it pleases, it satisfies, even if it's not superficially pleasing. You remember the end of American Beauty, where the character's looking at the dead body, and just for a moment, you're put into that sort of aesthetic moment, even though it's a, you know, blood and a body and and so forth. So yes, it satisfies, it pleases. And especially it does so because it communicates meaning. It communicates deep meaning from the heart of life itself. So let's move on. Gosh, there's so much one could say about that. I'd love to descant further upon that theme. But let's move on to the psychological dimension of it. I'm not going to say very much about this, but I think there's some useful sidelights from later Buddhist psychology, Abhidharma psychology. I know about this because I've just been preparing a book on the subject. Yogacara psychology, following on from more basic Buddhist Abhidharma, speaks of two processes whereby we distort and falsify the objects of our experience, the objects of our perception. The first way we distort them is we contaminate them with craving and hatred. So when we look at things, we look at them in the light of craving, for instance. We look at them as sources of satisfaction, sources of solidity, sources of enduring happiness, enduring security. So we distort them. We slightly bend them out of shape. We don't see them as they are. We slightly bend them out of shape by our craving or our hatred. Because when we see them as hateful, we don't see what's really there. We see the painting of our hatred. This is fairly commonplace, I think. I needn't dwell upon it. So obviously, in the aesthetic moment, we don't do that. In the aesthetic moment, we let go of craving and hatred to some extent. And I'll have more to say about this tomorrow. Or you could say, in Padmavajra will probably want to say, you transcend them. You even your hatred or your craving sort of pass beyond themselves. But they cease to distort. They you experience the object cleanly without ignoring its unpleasant aspects or ignoring its pleasant aspects, if you know what I mean, because in craving you ignore the unpleasant and in hatred you ignore the pleasant. But there's another kind of distortion which we do, and again we'll have much more to say about this tomorrow. We see the object in terms of its interest to us. Of course, that's what's going on with the contaminated craving. But this sort of distortion is much more to do with grasping. Even when we don't crave, even when we don't hate, we grasp onto the object as something real and permanent and outside us. So in terms of the psychology of perception, and the psychology of consciousness, contamination and egoistic distortion are the two ways in which we falsify our experience. Aesthetic experience begins to move beyond that. We stop contaminating the object and we stop egoistically distorting it. I'm just hinting at that now because I'm going to have more to say about this when I talk about the knower, probably tomorrow. But I want to move on to the metaphysics of it, or the philosophy of it, with quite a bit of trepidation, because I want to do this fairly briefly, and it's a very substantial topic. But in order to look at the aesthetic moment, I need to look a little bit more at the perceptual moment itself. Because in the aesthetic moment, we begin to let go of some of the fundamental building blocks of ordinary perception. Some of the things that enable us to construct a world and create an interpretive, intelligible interpretive framework for ourselves and our lives, some of that begins to break down. So when we perceive, what we do is we, you know, from a just a very basic common sense point of view, we take in the data of our senses and we construct out of that an intelligible world, a world made up of objects and distributed in space and time, and arranged in terms of causality, of causation. We see things as related to each other. We see them in terms of their distribution in space, related to each other spatially. We see them distributed in time, related to each other temporally. That's the basic building block of our ordinary perception. It happens naturally. It's what has been called the original disposition of the mind. The mind just does it. You don't have to learn how to do it, or rather you do learn how to do it, but in a completely natural way in relation to your mummy and daddy and the people around you. It just happens. You slowly learn how to interpret the world in terms of out there, in here, over there, over there, this, that, and the other. You samnya the world, you interpret the world and differentiate. You break up this undifferentiated flow of sensory experience into bite-sized munches, into discernible units, which you then relate to each other. We do this completely, naturally, spontaneously. And that is the arena for our ordinary lives. In fact, we're part of the arena, of course. But it's sort of even that is part of the interpretive framework. We see ourselves as having this interpretation. And again, we'll look more at that tomorrow. So we see the world in terms of space and time. It's out there, and it's coming from there, going to there. We see it in terms of relationships between things, that this is related to that, this comes from that, this gives rise to that. Without, you know, us being necessarily very good at it, we do understand the world in terms of causal connections and relationships. We couldn't perceive the world otherwise. It's part of the condition for our perception. It's a given. Subject and object, I'm in here having it, it's out there being had. Space and time, these are the sort of the containers for it. And causation, this is the relationship between the elements within it. We couldn't be awake, we couldn't be alive if we weren't doing that. When you have aesthetic experience, this begins to get broken down. It begins not to work in the usual way. It begins to be challenged. Of course, in our normal aesthetic experience, it only gets challenged, it only gets broken down to a certain degree. I believe if one can extend that aesthetic experience deeply enough and far enough, it breaks down utterly. But what we experience, for instance, is the beginnings of a breakdown between the subject and the object. We don't get so much of a sense as the object as out there and I in here. The object somehow moves closer to the subject. Of course, insofar as we're here and the object is there, space is still there, whether it's an audible or a visual or even an olfactory object. It's still, so to speak, out there. So space still is there. But the sense of time begins to fade or begins to expand and extend. So you begin to lose a sense of this as a moment simply as part of a flow of time. And for a few moments, in looking at that Miro canvas, that vast Miro canvas, time, you know, to say stand still would be to over-exaggerate my own aesthetic capacity. but it certainly slows down and it begins to recede into the background. The thing sort of stands there a little bit outside the flow of time, or at least the flow of time slows down, even stands still for a few moments. It varies from art to art. So, for instance, with music, certainly Western music, it's a little bit different with Indian music and even with minimalist music. The sense of the continuity becomes less important. So time becomes less of a significant factor. But in most art, the time begins to slow down. It moves out of its normal mode. And you cease to be concerned with the object as related to other objects, as being caused by other things. Of course, the object itself, when I'm saying object, I don't mean a single item, because, you know, even a canvas by Miró has a number of different elements to it. And it's the relationship between those elements, of course, that creates the aesthetic moment, or gives rise to the aesthetic moment. But those relationships stand completely unto themselves. They have no relationship to causal elements outside. As soon as you refer to those causal elements outside, like, how did Miró do this, you lose it. How did it get here? I wonder how they got it in through the door without breaking it. Or, as soon as you start to think about causal factors, you lose it. But when you're just suspended in this, to some degree, timeless moment, with only the internal relations of the object before you, that is the aesthetic moment. But something a little bit more that doesn't really come out of what I've said so far, or does come out of it, but I need to pull it out. Of course, the object isn't really an object. The object is not really out there, even in ordinary perception. You, my dear audience, are not really out there. You're not in here, fortunately, either. You're in a very mysterious state of suspension, somewhere between in there and out there. Anyway, stop, Samuti, get yourself under control. Where does my image of you come from? It's not an image, as it were, of you. That's the way it presents itself to me. It seems to me I am seeing you. But even in a common sense way, I'm simply seeing a messenger sent by you and reproduced in some mysterious way in my mind, whatever earth that is. My best illustration of this is a telephone call. I read somewhere, you know, that infallible source I read somewhere, well quotable in all scientific papers, as somebody says, something like 20% of the, the audible content, of a person's voice, is conveyed to you through the telephone wires in some way, reproduced electronically, and then, again through some mysterious process, recreated in the earpiece. But when I'm talking to you on the phone, I really think I'm hearing your voice. Actually, that's going on all the time. I really think I'm seeing you. In a way, that's what seeing you is. But what's happening is that an image is appearing, which is, you know, for practical purposes, a very efficient and effective image. Otherwise, I'm really wasting my time sitting here talking to you. An image is created, is produced, emerges in a way that is really fundamentally mysterious. And I say image, I think that's quite important. I think all perception is an act of imagination. All perception is an act of imagination. I get this insight from the excellent Kant, who speaks of imagination in these terms, that all perception ultimately is imagination. And then he speaks of art, as the aesthetic sense, as being the free play of the imagination, not bounded by the senses. But I just bow to Kant because he's such an important source for our understanding of the world today. So all our perception is an act of imagination. You could say an act of interpretation, but I prefer to say an act of imagination. What I'm seeing is an image. It doesn't seem like that, but it is that. It's just common sense. It doesn't take much to recognise that. There's light bouncing off you and onto the rods and cones at the back of my eye and going through the optic nerve to the visual cortex, and then emerges a visual image. An image. It's an act of imagination. So in aesthetic experience, what happens is that the imagination becomes liberated from its embedding, so to speak, in the flow of space, time, and causality. The act of imagination, the image itself, lives free from its context. This is not really fancy footwork here. This is something that I think you can directly experience. You take the data of your ordinary sense experience when you have a perceptual moment, when you look at the pond with the mist just smoking off the surface and the silvery gleam on the surface with the mist rising above it, the mist even reflected in the surface of the water. And you're pulled out of the moment. You're pulled out of your sense of what's going on. The more you can appreciate it, the less you're thinking of mist and ponds and cold days and so forth. The more you're simply drawn into the image itself, pulled out of the framework of our normal perception, space, time, subject, object, causality. You see the object liberated from its context. The image itself comes to life. And in the image is access to truth itself, we might say. The image itself, when we come really into relationship with the image itself is truth. But that is another story.